From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Today, we have the most important voice of all, and that's the voice of the jurors. They have spoken. Donald J. Trump has been convicted of 34 counts of falsifying business records.
This was a rigged, disgraceful trial. The real verdict is going to be November 5th by the people. And they know what happened here, and everybody knows what happened here.
Guilty. In a historic verdict, former President Donald Trump's convicted on all 34 felony counts in a hush money election fraud criminal trial. Trump is now the first former president to be convicted of a felony and faces up to 4 years in prison. We'll get the latest. Then two more Biden administration officials resign in protest over the administration's support for the war on Gaza. We'll speak with Alex Smith, a contractor for USAID, who resigned this week after his presentation on maternal and child mortality among Palestinians was canceled. We'll also be joined by veteran State Department official Stacey Gilbert. She stepped down this week, citing disagreements with a recent State Department report that claimed Israel's not obstructing U.S. humanitarian assistance to Gaza. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Guilty. After 3 weeks of testimony and less than 12 hours of deliberation, a Manhattan jury has found former President Donald Trump guilty on all 34 felony charges of attempting to influence the 2016 presidential election by falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment. Sentencing has been scheduled for July 11th, just 4 days ahead of the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee. Trump, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, is the first former U.S. president to be convicted of a felony. The maximum penalty is 4 years in prison, though Judge Juan Merchan could decline to send Trump to prison and instead impose a fine, probation or supervision. Trump's expected to appeal. He spoke to reporters outside the Manhattan courtroom after the verdict was announced.
This was a disgrace. This was a rigged trial by a conflicted judge who was corrupt. It's a rigged trial, a disgrace. They wouldn't give us a venue change. We were at 5% or 6% in this district, in this area. This was a rigged, disgraceful trial. The real verdict is going to be November 5th by the people. And they know what happened here, and everybody knows what happened here. You have a Soros-backed DA and the whole thing. We didn't do a thing wrong. I'm a very innocent man.
We'll have more on the historic conviction of Donald Trump after headlines. Israel continues its unabated attacks across the Gaza Strip. Overnight airstrikes on the Bereij refugee camp in central Deir al-Balah killed at least 11 people. Mourners grieve their loved ones at Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital.
What happened was we heard that there was a massacre in Bereij camp from the Al-Sus family. My daughter was there, and her children. She is their daughter-in-law. The whole house was martyred. The Israelis bombed the house. Her husband, her children, her father-in-law, her mother-in-law, her sisters-in-law were killed. The whole family was killed. My darling, my daughter.
A separate attack in Nusayrat camp struck a car carrying a family that had been providing free meals for displaced people. In northern Gaza, Israeli troops say they've retreated from Jabalia after 3 weeks of utter destruction. Displaced Palestinians returned to their homes, which in many cases were no longer standing.
I was displaced to the camp on the coast when the occupying forces came to the Jabalia camp. When we heard that they have withdrawn, we came back. When we came back to the Jabalia camp, we were shocked by the scenes of what has happened to it. Destruction. Homes have been completely razed to the ground, and what was not leveled to the ground was burned down, and what was not burned was completely destroyed.
Meanwhile, the charity Save the Children says Israeli strikes have killed at least 66 people, including many children, over a period of 4 days this week in areas of Rafah that were designated as safe zones. On Thursday, Hamas said it's ready for a complete agreement, including the exchange of hostages and prisoners, if Israel stops its war immediately. An Israeli negotiator dismissed the proposal as delusional. Israel's far-right finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, has threatened to turn the occupied West Bank, quote, into ruined cities like in the Gaza Strip. Smotrich, an advocate for illegal Israeli settlements, made the remarks in a social media video Thursday. On Thursday morning, Israeli forces stormed the West Bank city of Ramallah in another violent raid, igniting a devastating fire on a vegetable market. Dozens of stores were destroyed by the flames, causing vendors millions in damages as firefighters combated the blaze for hours. Humanitarian groups are condemning an Israeli bill to designate UNRWA as a terrorist organization. Doctors Without Borders called it, quote, an outrageous attack on humanitarian assistance and an act of collective punishment against the Palestinian people, unquote. The group added the bill, which is making its way through the Israeli Knesset, would, quote, amount to a free license to attack UNRWA facilities and its humanitarian personnel, unquote. The UN said this week aid to Gaza had dropped 67% since May 7th as Israel launched its invasion of Rafah. Yemen's Houthi movement said joint U.S.-British strikes killed 16 people and injured 40 others in Hodeidah province Thursday. The U.S. acknowledged launching 13 strikes against Houthi targets in Yemen as Houthi fighters have intensified attacks on freight vessels in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, including an attack earlier today on the U.S. Eisenhower aircraft carrier. The Houthi movement is vowing to continue its maritime strikes as long as Israel's war on Gaza is ongoing. Slovenia has become the latest European nation to recognize Palestinian statehood. The move still needs to be approved by the Slovenian parliament, which is expected in the coming days. A New York nurse launched a hunger strike outside the White House Thursday and is calling on all healthcare providers to oppose U.S. support for Israel's assault on Gaza. Jennifer Kooning said in a statement, quote, the immeasurable trauma that children in Gaza are experiencing is horrifying and completely unjustifiable. Children's brains and bodies are fragile and still growing, and they're being starved, bombed, and traumatized beyond belief. At this point, silence is complicity, she said. Earlier this week, 25 U.S. federal law clerks issued a rare public statement condemning, quote, our government's complicity in genocide, unquote. The statement was published anonymously, as judges and clerks are forbidden to engage in protest or other political activity. The law clerks wrote, quote, although the rules of the judiciary prevent us from publicly advocating at this time, we write this letter as a small gesture of our love and solidarity, unquote. President Biden's given Ukraine permission to defensively deploy U.S. weapons to strike targets inside Russia close to Ukraine's northeast Kharkiv region. The change in policy was widely reported Thursday, though the White House has yet to officially comment on the matter. The new directive does not apply to long-range missile strikes inside Russia. Earlier today, Germany confirmed it was allowing Ukraine to use German-supplied weapons in Russia's border area with Ukraine. Vladimir Putin this week warned of serious consequences if weapons provided by NATO members were used inside Russia. This comes as Ukrainian authorities announced at least 4 people were killed, another 16 injured in an overnight Russian attack in a residential area of Kharkiv, Ukraine's second largest city. Large swaths of South Asia continue to grapple with a blistering heat wave and soaring temperatures that have reached over 125 degrees Fahrenheit. In India, at least 24 people died Thursday of suspected heat stroke in the eastern states of Bihar and Odisha. Meanwhile, many residents in Delhi are facing chronic water shortages. Warnings have been acted across India as hospitals are seeing a spike in patients suffering heat-related ailments. This is a doctor in New Delhi.
We have got about 6 patients who were critical and they had heat stroke-like symptoms, and 2 patients were having heat exertion symptoms. So some of the patients were drowsy and they needed ventilator. And some of the patients had convulsions also. And one patient came gasping also to the emergency department.
CBS News reports the Biden administration's planning to send groups of immigrants from Latin America to Greece and Italy as an effort to discourage more people from seeking refuge at the U.S.-Mexico border. Under the initiative, people who are first processed at U.S. immigration centers recently opened in Colombia, Costa Rica, Ecuador and Guatemala could be resettled in Greece or Italy. The U.S. already has a similar resettlement partnership with Canada and Spain. And the U.S. Supreme Court has unanimously sided with the National Rifle Association, paving the way for a First Amendment lawsuit against a New York State official who encouraged businesses to cut ties with the firearms lobby. Maria Vullo, former superintendent of the New York State Department of Financial Services, had urged banks and insurance companies to stop working with the NRA following the 2018 mass shooting at a high school in Parkland, Florida. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. After 3 weeks of testimony and 2 days of deliberations, former President Donald Trump's hush money election fraud criminal trial ended Thursday with a historic verdict. This is Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg.
Today, we have the most important voice of all, and that's the voice of the jurors. They have spoken. Donald J. Trump has been convicted of 34 counts of falsifying business records.
Yes, former President Donald Trump has been found guilty of all 34 counts of falsifying business records to cover up payments made to Stormy Daniels in order to protect his 2016 presidential campaign. He's the first former president to be convicted of a felony and faces up to 4 years in prison, though Judge Juan Merchan could instead impose a fine, probation or supervision. Trump's defense team said it plans to appeal. Merchan set Trump's sentencing date for July 11th, 4 days before the Republican National Convention, where Trump will become the party's official presidential nominee. At the courthouse in downtown Manhattan, Trump slammed the verdict as a disgrace.
The real verdict is going to be November 5th by the people, and they know what happened here, and everybody knows what happened here. You have a sore respect, DA, and the whole thing. We didn't do a thing wrong. I'm a very innocent man.
Meanwhile, President Joe Biden's campaign said the verdict shows no one is above the law. Trump also faces 3 more criminal cases. We begin our coverage of Trump's historic conviction with Ron Kuby, criminal defense and civil rights lawyer based here in New York. Ron, welcome back to Democracy Now!. Your response.
Thank you. I was not surprised by the verdict. I was surprised that it came back as quickly as it did. Most of us who had been privately speculated that it would be late afternoon today, Friday, at the very earliest, if not next week. In thinking about it, you know, especially having the luxury of knowing what the verdict is, the prosecutor told this remarkably compelling story over a 6-hour period. I mean, he could have cut it down a bit, but he started at the very beginning with the conspiracy, how it was formed, who was in the room, brought in all the witnesses, integrated every piece of evidence, responded to the defense arguments in the process, and finished and really gave the jury, an entire script that they could follow if they chose to do so. And they did choose to do that. And since all of the charges stemmed from basically the same thing,
Which was
this falsification of business records for the purpose of concealing another crime. Once the jury found guilty on one count, it was very easy to find him guilty of all 34.
And, of course, you had those checks that President Trump signed with a Sharpie, famous 9 of the checks that were sent to Michael Cohen. Now, the defense had argued that Michael Cohen was a thief and a liar, but the prosecution said, you know, we don't get to actually always choose the perfect witness. He's basically a tour guide through the documents they described.
Well, I think the prosecution minimized his role somewhat. There were a couple of—the only person who could directly tie Trump to full knowledge of the hush money payments was Michael Cohen. But there was this, you know, tsunami of circumstantial evidence tying Trump to causing these payments to be made and these false entries to be made. And the jury very much relied on that. And the defense never posed any sort of realistic counter-narrative. That is, okay, if this isn't would-be President Trump doing all of this in order to gain an election advantage by paying off a porn star and people not knowing, finding out about it. Just what is it? Just somehow explain it. And the defense never even came close to providing an alternative explanation.
So President Trump has become a felon. What does that mean even before the sentencing? And then what do you expect on July 11th?
Well, one thing it means is he cannot own a firearm. Now, okay, he can become commander-in-chief and, you know, declare nuclear war, but he cannot personally own a firearm. It doesn't really change much in terms of his legal liabilities and the like. Mostly what it does is he's now introduced as convicted felon Trump. He faces sentencing on July 11th, and while even if he is sentenced to prison time, which I do expect that he will get some sort of carceral sentence, it will undoubtedly be stayed pending multiple appeals thanks to New York's very liberal bail laws, which the right wing usually attacks. But now I know somebody who's pretty happy that they exist on the
books.
And
so let's talk about what that means. July 11th, 4 days before the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee. If he was sentenced even to a week, he would miss the convention if he was frog-marched out of the courthouse into jail.
That's right. But he would not be so frog-marched. He would receive a stay either from Judge Mershon or from an appellate judge until his appeal can be perfected. And there are many appeals after that. So I think it's important to realize that, yes, Judge Mershon, in my opinion, is likely to impose a jail sentence. But no one is going to hear the steel door slam shut behind him for a long time, pending various appeals.
Can he vote?
He can.
He can.
He can, because he is a New York, this is a New York conviction. And so right now, as of today, it could change. In Florida looks to New York's disenfranchisement law. So the only way he can't vote in Florida is if he is actually in prison in New York on Election Day.
And in future show, we're going to look at those voter rights around the country and what happens to not just prisoners, but people who are free. Maybe he could be sentenced to home arrest or whatever. But under probation and parole, what are people's rights? I mean, in Vermont, you can vote from prison. In other places, you can't vote for the rest of your life if you've ever gone to prison, if you've been convicted of a felony.
And it's something that probably has yet to fully dawn on Trump's legal team. Is he remains under the carceral control of Judge Mershon. He is a defendant out on release, pending sentencing, and ultimately pending appeal, but Mershon maintains control over him. So if he goes out and commits other crimes, for example, the judge can impose additional restrictions on him or even do what the right wing has encouraged people to do with serial committers of crimes, lock him up.
You mentioned that President Trump can run for president as a felon and be president as a felon, but he can't own a firearm.
Right.
If he became president, could he change that law?
Well, Congress would actually have to change that law.
That's or executive order?
No. There's positive law prohibiting a felon from possessing a firearm.
And explain why he couldn't pardon himself if he were president.
The presidential pardon power applies to all offenses under federal law except treason and impeachment. It has no application to offenses committed under various state laws. The only person who can pardon President Trump in New York State is Governor Kathy Hochul.
So he could pardon himself in the federal documents case.
Yes.
He could pardon himself in the interference case,
yes.
Jack Smith's case, but not in the Georgia case that's upcoming under Fani Willis, that DA, and not in this case.
Excellent.
Under Alvin Bragg.
You got it.
So talk about Alvin Bragg and the significance of what he did today. Grew up not so far from President Trump in Harlem, went to Harvard, Harvard Law School, came out, and some criticized him for not moving faster on Trump. Others said, of course, Trump himself, that he'd been after him from the beginning. In fact, he skips over Bragg and talks about Biden, that this is an unfair Biden circus. How is Alvin Bragg related to Biden?
Their last names both start with B. There's no relationship there. And Alvin Bragg's career trajectory is not a trajectory of a traditional politician or somebody interested in seeking higher office. He won district attorney as a criminal justice reformer. He's done some good work in that area. He's not a headline seeker in any fashion. He's always remained sort of out of the spotlight. Relatively humble, not talking a lot about the cases. And I always thought this was a very solid case from the beginning. It wasn't the big grand case that Trump haters wanted, but it was a good, solid case based not on presidential abuse of power and presidential authority, but based really on a common, tawdry, dirty little grift.
Finally, summarize what he was found guilty of 34 times.
He was found guilty of 34 counts of falsification of business records for the purpose of concealing the commission of another crime. That is, every time they made a bookkeeping entry showing that Michael Cohen was being paid for legal services or signed a check for legal services, Trump knew and caused those entries to be fraudulent, and he did that for the purpose of concealing election law violations.
And not election law violation?
Well, that would be various either federal or state campaign contributions or conspiracy to affect the outcome of the 2016 election. You don't have to actually prove that he committed those crimes. You don't have to prove those crimes beyond a reasonable doubt. You just have to prove that the concealment was done in order to conceal the commission of those crimes. And let's face it, people don't cook their books just for fun. Usually when they cook their books, they're trying to cover up some other misdeed. There's well-established law about this. Usually in New York, the federal crime that they're committing is a Securities and Exchange Commission violation. Very common, regularly prosecuted, and something similar was charged here. It wasn't some way far out, tenuous legal theory.
Well, we're going to talk about the significance of the first former president to be convicted as a felon in a moment. Ron Kuby, we want to thank you so much,
a
criminal defense lawyer and civil rights attorney based here in New York. Next up, we'll speak more about what's next for Trump and his supporters with Professor Manisha Sinha, historian of U.S. politics, slavery, abolition, the legacy of the Civil War and Reconstruction. Back in 20 seconds.
I'm not going no small fret. Let me extend my apologies. Only big fret with big flag going overhead like canopy. Rag in my back pocket with a white vest, sneakers and wallabies. Knife tips and tight pants. I never really rate none of these. I come from brass festive, all from customs and from flour mills. Boss a fed, fire fed and licensing fed and them had a power pill. Everybody gunners and groovy bungee, only pushing power still. If it's me alone, leave me with power on a hill. I come here for no stand up. Hey, hey, hey. I come to party with my hand up. Hey, hey. So all soca people, put your two hand in the air. Your two hand in the air. Your two hand in the air. I never come here for no stand up. Hey, hey, hey. I come to party with my hand up. Hey, hey. All soca people, put your two hand in the air. Your two hand in the air. Yeah, yeah, yeah. All soca lovers do this. Show me your, show me your hand. Show me your, show me your, show me your hand. Show me your, show me your hand. Show me your, show me your, show me your hand. Show me your, show me your hand.
Hard Fact by Bungie Garland. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Former President Donald Trump will be sentenced July 11th, 4 days before the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee, after a New York jury found him guilty Thursday on all 34 counts of falsifying business records to cover up payments made to Stormy Daniels in order to protect his 2016 presidential campaign. Trump's vowed to appeal, also cases, three more criminal cases. For more, we're joined by Professor Manisha Sinha, historian of U.S. politics, slavery, abolition, legacy of Civil War and Reconstruction, professor at the University of Connecticut and author of several books, including The Rise and Fall of the Second American Republic, Reconstruction, 1860 to 1920. Professor, you last joined us on the day after the January 6th insurrection. Welcome back to Democracy Now! First, respond to this historic moment in U.S. history, not just U.S. politics, the first former president to become a felon.
Thank you for having me, Amy. Yes, it is extremely unprecedented because we have never had a case in United States history when a former president has been not only impeached twice, but also is now a convicted felon. Of course, there have been instances of corruption amongst presidents and vice presidents, but mostly they have resigned before they could be convicted, and they have been pardoned. What's unusual about Trump's case is that the extent of the criminality, the various cases against him, and now this unanimous jury decision convicting him for falsifying business records, but also, most importantly, for trying to corrupt the 2016 elections. All this is unprecedented in the history of American republicanism. As so much that concerns Trump, he wears this as a badge of honor. He seems unrepentant, even in the face of all these convictions. So, yes, I think we are, in fact, at a crossroads in the history of American republicanism, and a man like Trump could very much upend this over 200-year historical experiment in representative government.
So it's not clear what will happen July 11th, except that he will be sentenced by Judge Merchan. He could sentence him to up to 4 years in prison. It's highly unlikely he would do that. He could sentence him to house arrest. He could be out on probation. But if you can talk about this political significance of right before the Republican convention, what this means, you have a president now, a presidential candidate, who represents a lot of firsts in U.S. history. The first former president to be indicted, criminally tried, convicted, impeached twice. Talk about his legacy and what this means as the Republican frontrunner.
Yes, I think one of the most dangerous things about Trump is that he's not a one-man show. He is the presumptive nominee of a political party in a two-party system. That in itself poses an immense danger, I think, to American democracy. He's also now a convicted felon, as you mentioned. It's a Class E felony. He may not go to prison, but he's in the same category as those people who do carjackings or those who are accused of aggravated domestic assault. Now, this is a category of criminality that he is a part of. And I cannot help but think that any right-thinking American citizen, even a moderate Republican, would have to think about that. I don't think that this conviction, as many have argued, will actually increase his support. A minority that supported him will always support him because there have been so many acts of criminality and wrongdoing that has preceded this. I do think, though, that this will make an enormous difference to moderates, independents, will make them think twice. Do they want to actually vote for a felon, especially a party that pretends to stand for law and order?
So we spoke to you the day after the January 6th insurrection in 2021, Professor Sinha. In fact, you were among the historians included in one of the biggest briefs in Trump versus Colorado. Your work was also quoted. Can you talk about this case in the context of your new book, which focuses on the Reconstruction era and when the 14th Amendment was ratified, and explain it all?
Yes, you know, I, as a historian, really do feel that our present is shaped by the past. We are not exactly repeating history, but we live with those legacies. And in my book, when I look at this period, Reconstruction, that immediately followed the Civil War, I talk a lot about how ex-Confederates, insurrectionists, got away with, literally with murder. Right. They launch a program of domestic terrorism. They have committed treason against the government of the United States. And very soon, because of an amnesty law, they're back in power. They may have lost the war, but they win the peace. And that represents what I call a nadir in American democracy. I don't think many American citizens may be even aware that we have lost our democracy for decades, certainly in the South, where it was open season on freed people, and you had a regime of racial terror, segregation, and disfranchisement for Black men and later on Black women. And I don't think we can today go down a path where we similarly have a completely emasculated democracy. We live with the legacies of that period, as I mentioned to you. The 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which is a Reconstruction era amendment, is a sleeping giant. It does prevent someone who has participated in or aided and abetted an insurrection from ever running for federal office. Someone who has sworn an oath to uphold the U.S. Constitution. And the only way that person can do that is to be pardoned by Congress by a two-thirds vote. Now, it was very disappointing to me that the Supreme Court in the Trump versus Colorado case decided, including the liberal judges, that Trump, in fact, is not liable under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. In fact, he is. It's a very clear disqualification. Now, Congress could take away the disqualification for him. The idea that this would create a patchwork system where different states would then take Biden off the ballot actually does not work, because Biden has not led an insurrection against the government of the United States or proven false to his oath of office. This would be actually a national disqualification, even though the case stemmed from Colorado. So our Supreme Court did not have the, I think, the moral courage or judicial courage to do this. They thought only expediently about the political fallout from their decision. Instead, 12 ordinary American citizens defended our democracy. And this is exactly what Abraham Lincoln said on the eve of the Civil War, that the fate of our democracy actually lies in the hands, not of the rich and powerful, but in the hands of ordinary American citizens. And if you looked at the jurors, a lot of them didn't seem to me particularly anti-Trump. In fact, I thought maybe there's going to be a hung jury, even though the prosecution had an airtight case. So for this decision to come down sort of renews my faith in democracy, that if ordinary people, ordinary citizens get the chance to really deliberate on Trump's many crimes and misdemeanors, then perhaps we will get a right decision.
I wanted to end by asking you about a related story in the Supreme Court. Of course, President Trump appointed 3 of the 9 Supreme Court justices. And I wanted to ask you about this latest controversy around Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito, who told Congress he will not recuse himself from cases involving Donald Trump and the January 6th Capitol insurrection after photos emerged of 2 flags associated with election deniers flying in front of Alito's homes in Virginia and New Jersey. He said his wife did it, one of those upside-down American flag. So there are many who are demanding that he recuse himself from these cases. He says no. Your response, Professor Sinha?
Yes, you know, the Supreme Court in U.S. history has not distinguished itself as a defender of democracy. Think of Dred Scott, think of Plessy versus Ferguson. The Warren Court during the civil rights era emerges as an exception. We've had partisan judges before, but we have not had corrupt judges. We have not had judges sympathetic to insurrection against the government of the United States, whether it was Alito or his wife, whether it is Thomas or his wife. These two judges are clearly involved in planned insurrection against the government of the United States, or at least are displaying their sympathy for it very openly by flying an upside down American flag, which is a sign of disrespect, and the appeal to the heavens flag. The idea of simply, you know,
the appeal to heavens flag is that pine tree flag.
Exactly. The passing the buck on to his wife seems really ironic for somebody like Alito, who has taken away a women's fundamental right to decide for themselves how and what they do with their bodies. He has taken away reproductive freedom from a majority of women, and now he tells us that he bowed to the decision of his wife to display flags that were sympathetic to the January 6th insurrectionists. You mentioned that you had interviewed me immediately the day after, and even though I'm a historian who has studied American history and knows that there have been instances of grave danger to democracy in U.S. history, I was shocked, and you could see the shock in my face. To have a justice of the Supreme Court who is supposed to uphold the highest laws of the country be an active participant in this sort of behavior is just astounding. And the shamelessness of it is similarly astounding, that he would, after being sort of outed by the press, that he would refuse to recuse himself. Frankly, I think both Thomas and Alito are completely compromised, besides being very corrupt. They should either resign or, at the very least, recuse themselves. And I think it's about time for the Democrats to take a more aggressive position on this. At this point, we are not talking about some slight convention that has been upturned. This is a real threat to American rights and freedom. And we need to, you know, Biden likes to compare himself to FDR. Well, then think about packing the court. Think about judicial reform. We need to act against this. We cannot just let Alito decide for himself, because he's clearly incapable of making the right decision.
Manisha Sinha, I want to thank you for being with us. Historian of U.S. politics, slavery abolition, the legacy of the Civil War and Reconstruction, professor at the University of Connecticut. When we come back, we speak with two more Biden administration officials who've resigned in protest over the administration's support for Israel's war on Gaza. One official from the USAID and the other from the State Department. Back in 20 seconds. شعرك الفواح ممدود بعينك هالكحل ممدود حناك بني مزخرف ومفروض عبود ودعتك أنا بعبود من حيف انزفك لبحر أسدود مربوط قلبك بالهوى مربوط لا يوم Tufa by Yusor Hamed, featuring Maisa Dahl. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our next guest was a contractor for the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID. He resigned in protest over the Biden administration's support for the war on Gaza. For the past 4 years, Alex Smith worked as a senior advisor on gender, maternal health, child health and nutrition at USAID. Last week, he was scheduled to deliver a presentation on maternal and child mortality among Palestinians to a conference of USAID's colleagues and partners. But a day before he was scheduled to present, the leadership at USAID canceled his presentation. Smith says he was then given a choice between resignation and dismissal. He chose to resign. In his letter of resignation addressed to the head of USAID, Samantha Power, he wrote, quote, "I cannot do my job in an environment in which specific people cannot be acknowledged as fully human, or where gender and human rights principles apply to some but not to others, depending on their race. I can no longer in good conscience continue to be silent amidst USAID's de facto policy of ignoring human suffering when that suffering is perpetrated by an ally," Smith wrote. Alex Smith joins us now from Portland, Maine, in his first broadcast interview. Alex, welcome to Democracy Now! Explain what happened, how your presentation was canceled. It was a competition for having this place, this address, where Samantha Powers also addressed the conference. Can you talk about what happened?
Good morning. Yes, absolutely. I would like to talk about what happened, but I also do want to keep the focus on the people of Gaza and the West Bank and not make the headline about a privileged white guy who resigned his job. But yes, I'm happy to talk about what happened. Back in February, I submitted an abstract to the conference. It's a global gender equality conference that was going to be held in May. And that abstract was one of 368 that were submitted. One of the themes of the conference was going to be on intersectionality and maternal health. And I thought this would be an excellent opportunity to talk about Gaza. As we know, there are severe limitations for women to reach health facilities, where previously Gaza used to have very good attendance of skilled birth attendants. Now, almost all of the hospitals are non-functioning. And so I submitted my abstract. To my surprise, it was accepted in March. It went through three tiers of review. There were about 35 reviewers involved, and it was outsourced to an outside organization to review as well. So it was accepted, and I was very excited. I was thrilled to have a chance, a platform, to talk about maternal and child health outcomes in an ongoing crisis. The day before, the Monday before the Wednesday that I was going to present, I was told that I needed to meet with the Middle East Bureau colleagues and submit my slides. I did that. The slides went through many layers of editing and comments. I received a language guide. I was told to remove words like Palestine, Palestinians, Israel, Gaza border, and several others. And then there was a column of preferred language. I went along with that. I removed the word Palestine from the organization name UNFPA Palestine because that was objected to. I removed a map that UNOCHA provided that was acknowledged as an accurate map, but that couldn't be included because it showed the borders and the sea borders of Gaza. Also on that Monday, I was told this is a very sensitive issue because an hour before we were having our chat, the ICC request for an indictment came down from the prosecutor. And so I was told that it's a sensitive issue because of that. I mentioned that I was a legal fellow at the ICC back when I was in law school, that I had worked on specifically starvation as a weapon of war, and that was an area of interest of mine, and that I thought it would be useful to talk about international humanitarian law frameworks as they apply to every country, Gaza included. And I think that set off alarm bells. There were many more layers of editing, and then on Tuesday I was told that the presentation was canceled before I was told the presentation was deleted from the conference website.
I wanted to ask you about another part of your letter. You write, USAID defends human rights norms and international law when Ukrainians suffer from Russia's crimes. In Ukraine, we call for legal redress when people are victimized, named perpetrators of violence. We even work with human rights organizations collecting evidence for international prosecution. When it comes to Palestinians, however, we avoid saying anything about their right to statehood, the abuses they're currently suffering, or which powers have been violating their basic rights to freedom, self-determination, livelihoods, and clean water. What was their response to this?
There has been no response to my letter specifically, but that brings up a very important point that we are very vocal. We don't just deliver aid. We're vocal about human rights, democracy issues. When it's other countries or where adversaries are harming people, but we don't talk about it when it's people in Gaza and the West Bank.
So I wanted to talk about the head of USAID, Samantha Power. In fact, I believe she was one of the people President Biden sent to Michigan to deal with the uncommitted vote and to talk to Arab Americans. She, as head of USAID, was the first top Biden administration official to publicly acknowledge that famine is present in northern Gaza. I wanted to go to a clip. She was questioned by House Democrats. Joaquin Castro during a congressional hearing. Congressmember Castro said, so there's famine already occurring there? Samantha Power said, yes. Castro then asked Power how many children were at risk of dying in the coming weeks due to famine. She said, in northern Gaza, the rate of malnutrition prior to October 7th was almost zero. It's now one in three. One in three kids. So was she aware of the demand that was made of you to change all the language?
I don't know. I don't know who in leadership was told about the presentation. I know that there was a lot of chatter that I wasn't privy to about my presentation in the days leading up to it. But I don't know if she has seen the presentation slides or my resignation letter.
So, Alex Smith, you have your moment here. Your presentation was canceled. You're an expert in infant and maternal mortality. You were talking about the Palestinians in the speech you weren't able to give. Tell us, what is the situation?
So my presentation would have looked at snapshots of public health data, DHS data that USAID funds. Leading up to 2022, it would have talked about some of the challenges of not having clean water, of not having food security in most of Gaza, and also the checkpoints in the West Bank, that there have been risky roadside births before 2023. And then, of course, it would have talked about the impact of not having access to hospitals, of not having access to any maternity care, of having UNFPA provide home birth kits to try to prevent infection. But I really wanted to talk—I wanted to get the point across that if you stop food from going in and then you do start it again, it's not like flipping a switch where everything is fine. The starving pregnant women and children is going to have long consequences. It's going to have lifelong consequences for those people. It can even have epigenetic consequences for future generations. And I think it was important to understand that starvation as a weapon of war is illegal. And we need to acknowledge, and Samantha Power has acknowledged that, that there is a famine, but we need to take that next step of saying it is illegal and who's doing the starvation intentionally.
I want to end by turning to Samantha Power, the head of USAID, the author of A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide. This was an award-winning book that she wrote. In 2008, Democracy Now! Spoke with Samantha Power about the 94 Rwanda genocide, a period of around 100 days in which up to a million Tutsis and moderate Hutus were killed by Hutu militias, while powerful countries like the U.S. stood by and refused to stop the mass killings.
President Clinton didn't even call a cabinet meeting for the entire 100 days of the genocide, insisted on the withdrawal of peacekeepers, refused to pay for radio jamming, which would have blocked the radio that was being used not only to propagate the hate, but also to broadcast the names and addresses of potential victims who were getting away. I mean, it was an all-systems failure, but President Clinton was at the helm of that failure, and I think it's an American outrage, and I think President Clinton himself has made that plain, that it's the greatest regret of his presidency.
The greatest regret of his presidency. Samantha Power would go on to be the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Alex Smith, can you share your final thoughts as we go from President Clinton to President Obama to now President Biden?
Surely. On the same day that I was supposed to give my talk on maternal and child health outcomes in Gaza, the Israeli Minister of Strategic Affairs, Dermer, went on Sky News and told millions of people that there is no famine. There never has been a famine in Gaza. And I think it's shameful that misinformation can go around the world to millions, while we at USAID can't even whisper about it in a conference on gender and human rights and health outcomes. So I would like our leaders to do better. I would like them to stop gaslighting and say and speak truthfully about what is happening. We haven't seen that yet, and I think it's long overdue.
Alex Smith, we want to thank you for being with us. Just resigned as contractor for U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, in this exclusive interview. We'll also link to your letter that you wrote to USAID. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today with another Biden administration official who resigned over the administration's support for the war on Gaza. Stacey Gilbert served as senior advisor in the State Department's Bureau of Population, Refugees and Migration, which is the State Department's chief humanitarian office and features heavily in internal policy discussions over Gaza. This week, she sent an email to staff explaining her disagreements with a recently published State Department report that she worked on, but which concluded that Israel was not obstructing U.S. humanitarian assistance to Gaza. That report was used by the Biden administration to justify continuing to send more than $1 billion of weapons to Israel. Stacey Gilbert resigned after working at the State Department for over 20 years, joining us now from Baltimore, Maryland. Stacey, welcome to Democracy Now! Explain your final decision to resign.
Thanks for having me. About myself, I've worked for the State Department for a while, and it's not just working in the State Department. I've worked in humanitarian issues, refugee crises, basically most every refugee and humanitarian crisis involving conflict in that time. So Kosovo, Bosnia, Iraq, Afghanistan. My role in all of this specifically was supporting our team that oversees assistance to Gaza and the Middle East, but specifically working on this report. We were directed in early February by the White House to come up with a report that assesses different countries based on two things primarily. One is their adherence to, as Alex mentioned, international humanitarian law, which is the law that says there are wars, but there are rules in war. There's rules about the kind of weapons you can use, about making the distinction between civilians and combatants. And basically, it's a body of laws that says even in war, there are ways that you have to mitigate the consequences for civilians and soldiers. And we adhere to that. Israel adheres to it. It is international law. So this report was looking at adherence to that body of law, as well as whether countries allow humanitarian assistance. There were several countries we were assessing, but the one, unsurprisingly, that generated the most debate was Israel. I was working on this report with many others. There were a handful of us who were very, very engaged in every sentence of that. But at some point, we were removed from that report, and it was moved up to a higher level to be written and edited and cleared. Even though I had worked on this pretty heavily since this directive from the White House came out in early February, I did not know what was in the report until it came out. That said, I was actually hopeful that it would be an honest report, because earlier that week, the White House had made an announcement that it was going to pause the 2,000-pound bombs that have really caused disproportionate destruction in Gaza. So they had announced a pause on that, and I was actually pretty hopeful that maybe this report was going to be honest. So when the report came out on May 10th, late in the day, I read it, and I had to reread it because I couldn't believe what it said. It said very clearly, so on those two points, I was surprised on the point about Israel's adherence to international humanitarian law. for the first time I am aware of, we admitted in very, very weak terms, but we admitted that Israel is likely using U.S. weapons in violation of international humanitarian law. I was surprised. That was a step forward in admitting that. I was shocked, however, that it also went on to say that Israel, it is our assessment that Israel is not blocking humanitarian assistance. That is not the view of subject matter experts at the State Department, at USAID, nor among the humanitarian community, and that was known. That was absolutely known to the administration for a very long time, not just within the government, but having received reports and letters from organizations on the ground in Gaza, organizations the U.S. government funds, credible organizations saying Israel is blocking humanitarian assistance. And that's not to say that Israel is the only problem in this. There are certainly, it's a conflict, it's difficult. But these are professional organizations with expertise, local knowledge. They know how to work in conflicts. They know how to get to do the negotiations, to get the assistance to where it needs to be. They know how to do it. The issue is they are not being allowed to. And it's a range of issues. It's not just blocking trucks from going in, because we see over the course of this conflict, sometimes trucks go in, sometimes they're delayed, sometimes assistance goes in, but then it's ratcheted back. But we're seeing consistently through this a pattern of obstruction that the aid that prevents these organizations from doing their work and delivering this assistance to the people who need it. It's a variety of things. It's blocking, it's delaying or blocking visas for aid workers. It's causing trucks to be unloaded because there is a single item that Israel considers dual use. And the things that are considered dual use are incredible. Tent poles, flashlights, surgical scissors. All of these things, if found to be in a load of assistance, will cause the whole thing to be offloaded, back everything up. And it's this pattern of arbitrarily limiting, restricting, or just outright blocking assistance going in that has caused the very grave situation in Gaza that we've heard about. Famine. This is not hunger. Famine is a word that we are very, very cautious about using in the humanitarian sector. Words like famine and starvation are only used when very specific indicators have been met. So the fact that there is famine is extraordinary. That doesn't have to happen in a conflict, but it has happened here. And the remedy, when you've reached the stage of famine, the remedy is not more food. Absolutely more food is needed. But for people who are experiencing that extreme stage of malnutrition, that requires an immediate intensive medical intervention. And where are you going to find that in a country now where the hospitals have been destroyed? It's for the people who've reached that stage, it's too late. And any effort to bring in more food is absolutely necessary, but anything that comes in now it's too little too late. And the reason we've come to this point is because of Israel's obstruction. And to see that written in a report, a joint report from the State Department and the Department of Defense to Congress is ludicrous. And I was just...
Stacey, we just have 30 seconds. Your final message to President Biden.
Do the right thing. Listen to your experts. Do the right thing. It is difficult, but it is necessary because what we've done up to now has not worked for anyone. It doesn't help Israel. It doesn't help
the
people
of Gaza. And what is the right thing in this last 10 seconds?
The right thing is to acknowledge Israel is blocking humanitarian assistance, and there are consequences of that. And the consequences affect our military sales.
Stacey Gilbert, we thank you so much. Former senior civil military advisor in the State Department has just resigned. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.